Bow hunters are some of the hardest working hunters there are. Most of us work hard all year long just to get a couple weekends or burn our vacation time to sit in a tree. And just like the American blue collar worker, we're trying to balance work, family, faith, and a little time for ourselves in the great outdoors. Now let me introduce you to Trollco Clothing, a brand built by blue collar workers for blue collar workers. Workwear, comfortable tees, hoodies and hats for both men and women, Trollco represents the hardworking American. So whether you're operating heavy equipment, wrenching on engines, or in a factory living that shift life, Trollco has your back, literally. Head to trollco.com/hunting. That's trollco.com/hunting and enter the discount code Empire25 for 25% off of your first order. Trollco, for the hardworking American. This time of year, you're going to find me jigging for crappies off my father-in-law's boat, celebrating a successful turkey hunt, or just sitting on the back deck watching time go by with a quality cigar from Thompson Cigar. Thompson Cigar has been around since 1915, offering the widest array of cigars and cigar accessories at very affordable prices. Thompson Cigar offers your favorite brands like Swisher Sweets, Cohiba, Backwoods, and Monte Cristo shipped fresh directly to your door. Also, be sure to check out their 5-pack fever deals and join their value club for big savings. Visit thompsoncigar.com and enter the discount code SE at checkout for 20% off of all orders over $75. Thompson Cigar, quality cigars at affordable prices.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
Two Good & Co. coffee creamers are made with farm-fresh cream, real milk, and contain 3 grams of sugar per serving. That's 40% less than the 5 grams per serving in leading traditional coffee creamers for a rich, delicious experience. Whether you enjoy your coffee hot, cold, bold, or frothy, Two Good coffee creamers make every sip a good one. Two Good coffee creamers, real goodness in every sip. Find them at your local Kroger in the creamer aisle.
Close your eyes, exhale, feel your body relax, and let go of whatever you're carrying today.
Well, I'm letting go of the worry that I wouldn't get my new contacts in time for this class. I got them delivered free from 1-800-CONTACTS. Oh my gosh, they're so fast.
And breathe.
Oh, sorry. I almost couldn't breathe when I saw the discount they gave me on my first order. Oh, sorry. Namaste.
Visit 1-800-CONTACTS.com today to save on your first order.
1-800-CONTACTS.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Nation Podcast Network, powered by Interstate Batteries. From your truck to your trail camera, Interstate Batteries has you covered. Visit your local Interstate Battery store today or online at interstatebatteries.com. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
This is the Nine Finger Chronicles podcast, brought to you by Vortex Optics. What's up, everybody? My name is Dan Johnson, and I have a confession to make. I am pretty much addicted to bow hunting. I think about South Dakota. It's been probably 100 days in a row I've thought about that. I've thought about South Dakota bow hunting for mule deer every single day since I left in October. It really is distracting at times, because not only am I thinking about trying to shoot a mule deer with my bow, I'm also thinking about trying to shoot an elk with my bow, because there's a chance I draw an elk tag in Wyoming this year. And on top of it, I have my baseline whitetail addiction. So I am thinking about bow hunting almost all the time now. And it is a little bit distracting, especially when My wife is trying to tell me some kind of story about something that I don't care about, or I'm listening to somebody else like, hey, Dan, how's this and this? And like small talk. All I'm doing in my head is thinking about like hunting. And, I understand that, people may think I'm interested in stuff other than bow hunting, but I'm not. Like, it's crazy. It is crazy how much I think about bow hunting and just like the dumb shit, like access routes and wind direction and terrain and trying to gain access to new properties and just a whole bunch of new crazy. I don't know. I should actually try to get a psychiatrist on the podcast to talk about what actual addiction is. And see if maybe some of us have an actual bow hunting addiction. So that's where my mind's at right now. But we actually have a really good episode today. We're going to be talking to a guy out of Michigan. His name is Jack Ruthruff. And Jack in 2020 worked 1,200 hours of overtime. To put that into perspective, that's like an extra week a month or 2 weeks a month or something like that. Anyway, it's a shit ton of hours in a year. And so he only, between working overtime, you know, his regular job, he works all this overtime, his family and his other responsibilities as a husband and father, the dude only got out for five hunts, not 5 days, but five different hunts throughout the 2020 season. And he got the job done. And that's what this episode is about. You know, we kind of break down how he made this work with the limited time, with all, you know, the COVID thing going on. I guess you'll hear in the podcast what company he works for and what he makes, and I guess why there's a huge a demand on these products. So it's just a really interesting episode. I feel like if I'm hunting, you know, if I'm not scouting, if I'm not checking trail cameras, if I'm not planning or strategizing or trying to get out and do something, shed hunt, whatever, to improve my odds for the fall and then hunt my ass off in the fall, like I feel like I'm missing the boat. And this guy goes out and he gets the job done in five different hunts. So it's a really cool episode. But before we get into today's episode, we got to do some housekeeping real quick. Go check out the Land and Legacy. They're having these day camps, or I forget what they're actually called, but these places. I think there's one in Michigan or Ohio. I'm sorry, the details are completely wrong. And then one in the South. So one in the South, and then one in the North. And it's these field days where they walk you through all this habitat improvement stuff. So go to the Land and Legacy. Their podcast is on the Sportsman's Nation, just like this one is, the podcast network. And go check out these tutorials or these field days where they take groups of people out into the timber. There's a selected farm. They're gonna talk about all these. I think it's Michigan. Yeah, Michigan, and then another one down south. But it's just, they break down habitat improvement. They're going to talk about fire and plants, invasive species, like all these really awesome things. So do me a favor and go to the Land and Legacy Facebook page and Instagram feed and just look for that. Or you can just go to the Land and Legacy website and, get a hold of guys and ask them if learning about what these guys do interests you, because I'm telling you right now, they are the best in the game when it comes to habitat management. Right, these guys are the top, very top tier, and they're very knowledgeable, very intelligent, and they have a way of explaining what they do and how what they do works to people like me to make it easy. Right, so that's something to look at. Make sure you're following along on Instagram and Facebook, Nine Finger Chronicles and the Sportsman's Nation. Make sure you're subscribing to the Nine Finger Chronicles and the Sportsman's Nation RSS feeds. And you can do that at iTunes or wherever you download your podcasts. And I think that's it as far as housekeeping is concerned. I forgot to tell you this. First week in March, I'm going to record my very first episode of the Nine Finger Kitchen. And I'll tell you what, I'm just going to give you a sneak peek right now in what we're cooking. And it's venison meatloaf. It is one of my favorite recipes. There are no leftovers when I cook this, meal. My kids eat it. My wife eats it. Everybody loves it. And I'm going to throw that together on a video, and I'm going to launch it on the Sportsman's Nation YouTube channel. So keep an eye out for that. And now we got to do a commercial. And today's commercials are from Ozonix and Lone Wolf. Now, you guys know that I've been using Ozonix for a very long time. I mean, since the unit that I carried around was the size of a DVD player and about as heavy as a brick, no lie. I took it in the tree, one of the very first times that I ever used it, and some does got downwind, and they put their nose in the air, and they didn't really blow, and they kept moving through. And I was like, right then and there, I go, are you kidding me? Like, I had what they call an aha moment. Right. And since then, obviously, their units now are putting out way more ozone. They have new products like their locker and their dry wash bags. And basically what those are is not only can you use the unit in the tree in your hunting strategy to cut the wind and protect your downwind side, but then once you get out of the timber, you can hang all of those dirty, soiled clothes. And when I mean dirty, I don't mean mud dirty. I mean scent dirty. You hang it in there, you'd run a dry wash cycle on their unit. All that ozone kills the germs, bacteria, and scent. You put it back on, you're feeling fresh for the next hunt. So if you want to find out more information about the Ozonix units, go to ozonixhunting.com. And I do have a discount code here, Ozonix, and it's NFC19. Pretty sure that's the most accurate and up-to-date discount code. But when you purchase a unit, enter that discount code NFC19, and you get a free dry wash bag with your purchase. I think that's like $100. So it's a free dry wash bag with the purchase of any unit. And I'm telling you right now, both in the field and out of the field, it's a big deal, man. I love that product. Second, Lone Wolf, man. I mean, what do you say? It's like an appendage on me by this point. It's easy to set up, and I've been using it for a long time. So it's almost like breathing. I'm not having to think about it. I feel confident with this product. And when you feel confident with a product and you don't have to think about that product when I'm tearing down or setting up and tearing down, making moves all season long, it's quiet. I know it's going to perform, and it does what I need it to do, and it puts me in the right spot, not the right tree. I don't need a straight tree, right? And that's the big difference between a lot of the stands that are on the market. It's, oh, well, my stand can't get in this tree, and then guess what? Buck walks 10 yards outside of your shooting, lane because you were in the wrong tree. You needed to be in a crooked tree, and Lone Wolf allows you to set up in a crooked tree, man. I mean, that's really all there is. It's not heavy. It's not cumbersome. And once you learn how to use it, goes up quick, comes down quick, and it's very quiet. And that's what I need personally when I'm running and gunning all over the timber. So if you want to find out more information about all of the products that Lone Wolf Portable Tree Stands offers, go to lonewolfhuntingproducts.com. And if you want to save some money on your purchase, here's the discount code, and that is 9FC50. And what that's going to do is it's going to allow you to save $50 off all orders over $200, right? So you buy a tree stand for like $250, and you're going to take $50 off, and there you go, it's only $200. So that's a win right there. All right, long intro. I apologize. I just had to cover all those bases. Let's get into today's, hunter profile, success story type of podcast with Jack Ruthruff. 3, 2, 1. All right, on the phone with me today, Mr. Jack Ruthruff. Jack, how we doing, man?
Good. How you doing, Dan?
I'm doing good, man. And you're all the way from Michigan, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Right, so, in mid-Michigan.
All right. So let me ask you a question. I went to Michigan. I hunted there for like 3 or 4 days. I struck out. Does that make me a bad hunter, or is that pretty much standard for hunting Michigan that time of year?
Oh, not at all. That Michigan is, Michigan can be very, very tough, very, very tough. I know you were definitely hitting the public land pretty hard, and my hat's off to you. Public land hunting in Michigan is very, very difficult, and that's a new challenge I'm going to be trying to take on this year myself.
Yeah.
But no, you are not a bad hunter at all.
Well, that was an opportunity for you to just really slam me and be like, of course, dude, of course you're a bad hunter, right? Of course you are.
Right.
So, you live in Michigan, mid Michigan in the mitten, right? What do you do for a living?
I work for a manufacturing company. I work for S.E. Johnson, and we make about 95% of all the Ziploc brand bags in the world come out of a little site here in town.
Okay. That's crazy, because I know a guy who works for Reynolds Wrap or something like that. And I think he makes all the tinfoil, that kind of it.
Yep.
Lots of tinfoil. So, you're in the, he's in the tinfoil game. You're in the Ziploc, bag game. And, those are two products that are probably, if not in every household in America, in a lot of them.
Yeah. Yeah. It's been very, very busy, to say the least, with the pandemic going on. Demand skyrocketed for our product. So,
do you know why that is?
It's been very busy. A lot of people, when the meat shortages started to happen, they were going into meat markets, buying up their meat, and then they want to throw it in the freezer, so they're buying Ziploc freezer bags to throw their food in the freezer and preserve food as long as they can.
Yeah. And it's not like plastic bags are really reusable, right? Most people don't rinse them out and use them again. So it's one of those products. It's like a one-time use deal and just keeps going and going. And it's funny. I shouldn't say it's funny. Maybe it's funny. Maybe it's not, depending on what way you're looking at it. But it says here, 1,200 hours of overtime. You worked 1,200 hours of overtime in 2020.
In 2020. And I didn't work any overtime in the month of November, because I wanted to spend time with the family and hunt.
Okay. So,
but yeah, 1,200 hours.
Man,
overtime.
That is crazy. Like, I never ever calculated it, but there was a time when I worked in Alabama. I worked at a factory, and it was third shift work. So, it was a Tyson plant where they would make chicken strips and cubed meat for soups. So we had a breading station. We had a big freezer that we had to clean. We had like the raw areas that needed to be, cleaned all the time. And man, there was a time where I think I worked 120 plus days in a row at bare minimum 12-hour days. I can remember being there for 14 to 16 hours someday, and I was the crew. I was the manager who led the sanitation crew. So we were there at like 8 o'clock at night, waiting for them to get done, and then we would run we would clean all the equipment, and then the USDA would have to inspect it before they could start running their meat, the next morning. And man, sometimes. It was extremely messy in there, and it sucked, and it wore me out.
Yeah. I can only imagine.
Yeah. So, but $1,200 of OT, man, or 1,200 hours of OT, I bet you like those paychecks.
Yeah. The wife really liked them too.
Did any of that money make it into your hunting budget?
I bought some tags. That was about it, I think.
Yeah.
This year.
Yeah.
She did let me buy a saddle this year. So that's going to be on the 2020, it's going to be in the 2021 arsenal, I should say.
Gotcha. So you jumped on the saddle wagon, huh?
Well, I've got an Assault, an old school original Assault at home too, four sticks. So I just want to add it as another tool and another option, depending on where I'm going and how much running and gunning I'm going to be doing. So.
Yeah. Yeah. So let me ask you this. You ended up working, like, I'm doing the math here. And that's what we're going to talk about today. It's about, you got the job done on two really good deer in Michigan this year, with very limited hunting because of your work schedule. And so I just did some quick math. So each month you did, you basically worked 2.5 weeks extra, right? If we're basing everything off of mm-hmm. a 40-hour work week, you in an average month, you crammed 2.5 weeks more hours into every month than a regular 40-hour shift. So just that alone, right, probably makes a guy tired, and it limits everything else. Yeah, it limits everything else that you can do within a certain month. So let me ask you this: working so much, and, you know, obviously that takes away from a lot of different things. How did you still go about, I don't know, did you do any types of summer scouting, or did you hunt on a property that you already knew? Did you, you know, did you run trail cameras? Did you just wing it? And do you think this season was straight luck?
One property, I shot, a buck on November 1st on, that is, a small 4-acre parcel that we have had for over 30 years. So that one, that property I already knew, pretty much have had dialed in for years. I do run trail cameras on it in September, early October to get my inventory. And then I just stay and I'll check them about every 4 days, midday, and wait till just the right conditions because of it being such a small parcel of property and not trying to blow everything out.
Yeah.
And that one, that buck, I was able to harvest on a well-known property. The other buck, it was pretty much, I didn't scout it until October 3rd. I hung my stand, figured I'd get with it. I tried to find the spot within the spot. I scouted October 3rd. Shot a doe October 5th and stayed out till the rut and shot my biggest buck in Michigan on November 13th. So I just tried to optimize my time as best as possible when I came to scouting, finding the exact spot I wanted to be in, and then stayed out and waited until the conditions were perfect.
Yeah. So did you hunt much in October at all?
I hunted one day on the 4-acre parcel and one day on the other property that I shot a doe on October 5th. I hung my stand on the 3rd. I shot her on the 5th. And then I hunted October 25th on the 4-acre parcel.
Okay.
And I didn't see anything. So that was pretty much my pre-rut scout. And that was it.
Gotcha.
More of an observation set.
Gotcha. So only 2 days in the month of October, two hunts in the month of October.
Yep.
Okay. And then you hunted, obviously you killed a deer on November 1st and the 13th, and that brings us to four hunts. And then was there a hunt in between? Cause what did you say? You only hunted 5 days,
5 days,
five days
around November 8th or 9th. When that real warm streak spell hit the Midwest, I did hunt one day in that.
Yeah.
And, it didn't pan out. I got drawn back on a doe from the ground at about 4 or 5 yards away, but she spooked before I could get the trigger pulled.
Yeah.
So
what's your mindset going into something like that? Cause if someone came up to me and said, Dan, you can only hunt 5 days in this whitetail season here in Iowa, I would probably have an anxiety attack and pass out. Right. Like, what? Oh no. You're like, so many things would have to change for me. Is this a normal occurrence for you, or was it just this year?
It's since the kids have come along, it's kind of started to become more of a norm. I just try to be as selective as possible to on my days that I do get to hunt, to put myself in the right position to harvest an animal. And, you know, especially this other property, I just started to be able to hunt this year. Other than that, I was just hunting 4 acres the last 8 or 9 years since our farm was sold.
Gotcha.
That we were hunting on. So I pretty much have it dialed in. It's just, I try to be selective then on what days I can go in there and really push the limits.
Yeah.
Because with it only being 4 acres, it's very easy to blow it all out.
Yeah. And I have a feeling, if I had to guess, I would say that there are more people in your shoes. Let's just say that the Sportsman's Nation and the Nine Finger Chronicles was, you know, like, I still honestly don't even consider this a real job, right? But let's just say all things are the same, right? I still spend a ton of time throughout the year traveling. You know, I would be using PTO and even before this, when I was still living that cubicle life, I spend a lot of time, doing all these other things to prepare for the season. Are you still doing all of the ton of preparing, or are you the kind of guy who just is like, I pick up the bow a couple months before the season starts, start shooting, or are you shooting all year? Do you have like your tree stands already set? What's your layout like?
I try to shoot all year. I mean, I was very blessed. Before my dad passed, I grew up in this industry. He was a rep over the road covering 4 states and worked for a lot of different manufacturers in the hunting and archery industry. So I try to shoot as much as I possibly can year round. Okay. On the 4 acre parcel, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Oh, on the 4 acre parcel, that's pretty much a couple of set stands, but now I am going to do some work on the property this year, get it cleared out some more, plant some food plots, and try and go mobile on it, even though it is only a little 4 acre parcel, just so I can try and play just off the winds a little bit better, put myself in a little bit better position to get closer to their bedding, which I'm really tight now, but I want to get even tighter. And the other parcel that I was just able to start hunting this year, I'm going to start going more mobile. So the scouting will start a lot more in the spring and summertime, now that I have other properties that I'm going to be able to hunt. And Bob Miller, one of your previous guests, he and I are going to start hunting some public land. We've known Bob for quite a long time, and we've become pretty good buddies since he got me going on your podcast. So we're going to start hitting some public ground together. So we give each other a little bit of a hard time. He's a lone wolf guy and a tree stand only, and I'm getting into the saddle game. So we like to give each other a hard time about that going back and forth.
I feel you. All right. So with, you know, being selective, it is great, right? You have this limited time. You have this smaller, let's just say, for all purposes here, we're talking about 4 acres, right? So you know from hunting it over the years when you can and when you can't go in and hunt it, right? If it's is there a right. certain wind on that property where it's just a no go? All right, I can't hunt it on this wind.
North and south winds are actually typically the worst, and east. Dead west wind is typically best, or a northwest or a southwest. It's a narrow piece that runs lengthwise east and west. So if I try to get into the middle, I hunt on one end of it. If I try to get into the middle, a north-south wind blows my wind everywhere in there. To the west is really heavy bedding in a big ditch where they like to go to get water. So the east is really, really pushing it. I got to wait for it to be a very, very calm east wind or have pictures essentially of the deer on the east side of the property to really warrant me even getting too deep into it.
Right. So Here's a problem that I used to have a while ago. I would say maybe 6 years ago, 7 years ago, where I had the ability to hunt. The wind wasn't necessarily the right way. And I was never the guy who said, yeah, I'm just playing off tonight. I'm not going to go in. I'm going to go somewhere and I'm going to hunt. Right. And if I knew a big buck was in an area, I would try to find a way to get in there. And most times some way, shape or form, I would probably get busted or I would bump something coming in or whatever. So how hard is it for, you know, let's just say you had a day off or, you know, or the conditions were not necessarily right, but you had some time to hunt. Like, how hard was it to stay out of some of these farms given that you did have, you know, some time to throw at hunting?
I almost had an anxiety attack a few times. Years ago, in 2012, I was chasing 100, which some guys might not think it's big, but in Michigan standards, it's big. I was chasing 130, 135-inch split brow, split G2 buck back there that I had pictures of them early October, like the 5th, and then the 25th of October, and I stayed out of that property until November 5th, and I know there was 8 guys within a half a mile there that were chasing after that deer.
Okay.
And I was the only one that put eyes on him in daylight hours.
Yeah.
But I waited. I just stayed out and stayed out and stayed out and waited and waited and waited. And it was killing me not to go in there after him.
Yeah.
Knowing he was in the area, but so, oh, it was hard.
Let me ask you this. What sucks worse for you? Having to play off in some of these scenarios where the wind isn't right and the conditions aren't right, but you have the time, or the opposite where the conditions are perfect, but you have to go to work?
Ugh. I don't know which is worse. I think when the conditions aren't right, we're busy enough at work, I could at least justify it by calling and going in and, you know, see if they need help. And I could play it off in my head that, oh, don't worry, I'm going to work. But if I'm stuck at work, I think that's actually, with the perfect conditions, that's probably worse.
Yeah. Yeah, man, I can remember, you know, I can remember when I first took the jump over to, you know, when I got laid off from my real job and started working here. I was just remembering like, okay, well, I got to do this, this, and this. And I would look at the weather and I would say, oh my God, there's a mini cold front coming through here in October. I'm going to go hunting tonight. And I could go hunting as opposed to, or maybe a morning hunt. And in the past it was like, okay, well, if I do this, I got to calculate my time off. Am I able to take it off? And if I do take it off, how is that going to affect my other hunts? You know, if I have my rut vacation and all these things. So everything was so calculated down to the specific hour, and I took every single hour of PTO that I could.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. How many hours of PTO do you get?
It's around 110, 111. We work 12-hour shifts and it's just shy of 10 days. Basically like 10 days. It's like within an hour, a couple hours of 10 days off.
Okay.
So,
all right. So 10 days off. And so where does most of your vacation then go? Those 10 days, are those 5 days of hunting? And then, you know, some goes to the family and sick leave, or how do you distribute that?
We work a swing shift. So fortunately I didn't have to burn a hour of vacation to hunt these 5 times. But, cause we swing from days to nights and nights to days, and we have a kind of a difficult schedule to get used to, but, it does allow hunting like during the week when there is less pressure and commotion.
Yeah.
So most of my vacation time and PTO time goes to the family.
Yeah.
Cause then I can spend more time with them doing that. And then when hunting season comes, my wife is usually pretty understanding and helpful. and then my mom helps with watching the kids and stuff too. So we have a pretty good system going. But we'll see this year. She's starting to lighten up the rain, so maybe I'll be able to spend some more time in the woods and whatnot, burn up some of the vacation doing that.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, as long as mom's happy, everybody's happy, right?
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
So let's talk a little bit about these two deer that you ended up, harvesting or killing this year. What? Let's start with the small acreage, the four, right? We have already talked a little bit about, you know, the conditions that you need for that particular piece. What makes this little 4 acres huntable? All right. Talk about the terrain features. Is it thick? You know, is it surrounded by other blocks of timber or ag, or, you know, is there a funnel through it?
It's thick. Used to be nearly, almost like a CRP type field with just a few trees in it that, and you could see all the way to the back. It's just a real narrow. It's only about 50 yards wide, and about 400 yards deep. And over the years, the buckthorn and autumn olive and tag olives have taken off. And there's two clearings, what I call the on the front side on the east, that are about 30 yards across, circular shaped, and then they pretty much join together on one corner of them. And that is where it's so thick, I believe that's where the deer like to just start to relax and go to, just to get away from out of the thickness.
Yeah.
So I hunt on the very east end of it, but you can't see, once you get into the tag olives, you can't, into the buckthorn, you can't see 12, 15 feet in front of you. I mean, it's so thick. And these two little clearings that are left that haven't grown over, we planted some alfalfa in there a few years ago, and so there's still a little bit of that sparsely in through there. There are some oaks bordering the property in a couple of spots, so they use it more as a travel corridor, and the does like to stay up towards the front, and the bucks like to travel north and south on the western end of the property. And then as the rut comes, they will start to use the trails closer and closer to the east. And they will then visually check the both clearings from the west side of it. As far as the layout, it's pretty tough to beat for around here.
Yeah. So is it more of a doe bedding area and the bucks move in during the rut, or is it a holding spot for bucks all year round?
I mostly hold the does. Yeah. I know a guy about a mile and a half away who gets a lot of trail camera pictures of the bucks that I shoot. He holds a lot of the bucks over there in October and then up until the end of October. And then it seems like they all migrate over to the piece of woods that we have. Our 4 acres is a small chunk in about a 45 acre parcel of woods. And they travel from where he's at. So he has the bachelor over there, and then they come over to our property during the rut. And the buck I shot this year, he had a picture of that buck 24 hours prior to when I shot him, and that was a mile and a half away. So. Yeah.
So you got the does, and the does are very important, as we all know, right?
They are.
So.
Yep.
So, I mean, is there a time of year then that, you know, you've been hunting this property, the small property, for a very long time, and it seems like you've got it kind of figured out? Do you ever make moves into it early or stay out of it even during prime time and maybe wait till after the rut's over? Or is it always, I know that I need to be in there the first week of November or the first, you know, however many times during November, or are you flexible with that and say, hey, man, I have enough data where I should go in now, and whether that's December or October?
It's usually the first 10 days of November, just like most of the Midwest, that peak into the peak of the rut. I'll throw my rubber boots on and probably push a little more than I should once in a while around Halloween and maybe November 4th. If I haven't seen anything on my cameras, and I'll take a trip to the west side of it, to the back, see if I'm finding scrapes or rubs. And if I'm not, then I literally will just wait another week and then I'll get aggressive. I do have a couple of stands towards the back, and they're risky because it is such a small piece. Yeah. I will push it to get all the way back there, but that's a pretty much a swing for the fence.
Yeah.
Because when I come walking out, I'm usually blowing everything out of there and I won't see anything for a week or two.
Really? So it's one of those things where it's basically a, is it a morning spot or an evening spot?
Both. This year I shot that buck in the morning. And then last year I shot the buck that I harvested back there. I shot him in the evening. So both morning and evening, not much midday, actually. Yeah. Not much midday, but mostly the first hour of daylight and the last hour.
Is there do you have a preference on that farm? It sounds to me like it. There's not really one, but historically, has that small piece been a better evening or a morning spot?
Mornings during the rut.
Okay. All right.
And I shouldn't say it because I'm a moon guy. I do love a full moon. But during the rut. Something about it on that piece of property, it almost seemed to condense, say, a 7 to 12 day peak rut for chasing. It narrows it down almost to like a 3 to 4 day on that. For something in particular about the full moon, I've been watching it for, I don't know, about 15, 20 years now.
Yeah.
And if that full moon lands from November 1st to November 10th, it's like my rut activity on there condenses right down on the chasing to about 3 days.
Okay.
And then it's done.
So you don't want a full moon in that time frame?
I do.
Oh, you do?
Yep.
Okay.
Oh, I want a morning full moon. Something about it on that, I don't know what it is, but that property, I've shot more bucks in the morning during coming off of the full moon, like if it was the full moon that night, than if I was to wait until what they say is a better time, during the rut, I guess I should say.
Okay. All right. So talk to us a little bit about what this deer was doing on November 1st when you ended up shooting him. And do you have any history with this buck?
I got pictures of him on October 2nd with another 8-point about the same size. They were also sparring that night. I got a picture of them coming up a trail, and then they were sparring in front of the camera with a smaller third buck behind them. And I didn't have another picture of them at all the whole month of October. And then I took the kids out trick-or-treating. I told the wife I got to hunt in the morning, and it was rainy and cold that night, and I was able to slip out to the blind I was hunting out of. And I got out there about a half hour before daylight, and I happened to get settled in. And next thing I know, there's a doe standing out there in front of me at about 30 yards. And she took off to the north, and I could see her under the full moon in the twilight. And all of a sudden, I couldn't hear him, but I heard him grunting. And I pulled my binoculars, and some cloud cover had cleared, and it got light enough I could see the frame of his horns. All right, well, I know there's a deer run, a buck run around here. And he chased her to the north. They came running out from then just about underneath me. He pushed her to the south. And about 10 minutes later, she stepped back out in front of me. As it's getting, I'm waiting for it to get lighter and lighter and waiting for legal shooting light. And then I can hear him grunting. And I can't see him as this cloud cover keeps blocking the moonlight. And I'm now waiting for it to get to daylight. And then all of a sudden I caught a glimpse of him. And he's bedded 25 yards away from me, quarter to me, staring at me. And, or looking in my direction, I should say. So I'm just waiting for it to get lighter and lighter. And I can see her walking around once in a while through my binoculars. And got to be about 10 minutes after legal shooting light, and he finally stood up, and he took about 3 or 4 steps because she had started to get a little antsy. He bedded down in front of me for about 35, 40 minutes.
Yeah.
And once he stood up, he took about everything he had on him to get stood up. So I knew he had just started chasing. Cause he hadn't thinned out at all or anything from chasing yet. And I let him take about 3 or 4 steps. And that was when I was able to take the shot.
Nice. So was he doing what, like all the deer had been doing, like just kind of working their way through the property, or was he actually nose to the ground, like searching for does?
He came from the west. And when he came, typically there, he came, when I first saw him and he was grunting, his nose was to the ground, and then he started pushing her everywhere and had his nose to the ground when he pushed her off to the south, and then when she stepped back out, and then she wanted to kind of mill around and feed around the CRP type grass and the alfalfa a little bit. And he just bedded right down.
Yeah.
Waiting for her to get done. So that's, it was killing me though, to know he was laying down there, and then for it to get to be legal shooting light, then for it to get to be plenty of light without even a question. And he's sitting there quartered at me. At that point, he was maybe 25 yards away.
Okay.
And I was using my dad's crossbow that he was given to him. And so I had this crossbow, and could have easily, I didn't want, there was a tree covering his vitals, or the bottom 2/3 of his vitals, and I didn't want to take a shot. But to sit there and watch that deer, knowing it probably would have been, at that time, would have been the biggest buck I had shot in Michigan, at 25 yards away, quarter to me, was had my adrenaline going, to say the least.
I believe it, man. So let me ask you this. You know, this was this the biggest buck you've ever shot?
In Michigan.
Okay. So it's still something special, right? Maybe not the biggest buck you've ever shot, but for the state that you live in, I mean, it holds some kind of importance.
Right.
You know, are you the kind of guy who gets really fired up and maybe gets a little case of the buck fever, or have you learned to tame that?
Usually I get the big adrenaline dump as soon as when I see a buck that I want to shoot. And then if I'm able to get about 30 seconds to a minute to calm down, I can usually calm down without a problem and take a shot, whether it's compound, crossbow, rifle. If I'm given a minute to get my composure, it's usually not a problem. But for some reason, I think it was the duration of waiting almost 35, 40 minutes for this deer to get up, or for it to get light enough to shoot and to get the legal shooting time, and then wait for him to stand up and make his move. That was probably the hardest part. And that's probably what got me rattled more than that, you know, the most. But yeah. Usually I'm pretty calm and able to make the shot.
Yeah. Well, that's good, man, because I don't know. There's still a part of me that suffers from the two things. One, if I have history with a deer, with a buck, and I think I've mentioned this before on another episode, but if I have history with a deer who's a shooter, let's just say I've seen him as a 2-year-old, 3-year-old, and now he's a 4-year-old or whatever that those numbers are, and I see him coming my way or see him in the field or whatever, knowing that he's a shooter and I've watched him or passed him previously, that gets me fired up, right? I mean, really fired up, as opposed to I don't get near as fired up if I identify a buck through my binos or see one coming that I've never seen before. So mm-hmm. I don't get fired up that way, but there's still a little part of me that, you know, if it's the biggest deer I've ever seen, or if it's the biggest deer I've ever shot, or, you know, I still get buck fever, a little bit of buck fever when those scenarios kind of play out.
If you don't get buck fever or a big adrenaline dump, then it's time to hang it up.
Right. Yeah. There's a little part of me, but at the same time, man, I don't know about you, but I wish I could be the guy who's just that stone cold, no emotion killer, right? Where the buck comes in, you slay it, and then you can break down and have that buck fever. I wish I was like that, but I'm not quite there yet.
I'm usually better with that with bears than I am with deer.
Yeah, I don't know.
For some reason, I don't know why. I don't know why, but a bear, not a problem. A deer does tend to get a little more buck feverish at the moment of the shot.
Yeah, but I don't know, man. I when it comes to animals that I'm not currently all worked up about, like, when I went elk hunting one time, I had some bugles. I mean, they were real close. The bull actually came down and my buddy had like a 25 yard shot at it. And, it had me excited, but it didn't have me as fired up as a whitetail hunt I knew, like, at that point I have a job to do, right? This is my job. I got another guy down the hill trying to call it in or whatever, but it was a really, I don't know. It's just something about whitetails. And if I have experience with that particular buck that mm-hmm. it gets me crazy. So you ended up shooting this deer. And when you shot it, you know, after you shot it, did you drill it right away and you knew it was dead, or did you have any type of questionable shot?
No, I knew I pretty much knew I'd drilled it. He went about 75 yards. He actually went further than I expected. I mean, I took out both lungs and the liver. And I just, I knew I'd hit him well, but I think because he was so rutted up, the doe he was with, she took off and that was the direction he went. And I can't believe he went as far as he did, but I expected him to see him piled up at about 40 yards. But I think he was just so running up and on so much adrenaline that, and with chasing her, he didn't know what had even happened.
Yeah, yeah. So let me ask you this: after you, did you realize what you shot at that point? What I mean, did you know it was potentially going to be your biggest Michigan buck at that point?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes. Okay. So, you held it together, you drilled him. And now what was, you know, I always love this question. The first time you ever, like for me, it's something special. The first time you ever get a walk up to the buck that you just killed and you pull his head up and you grab his antlers for the first time, what was kind of running through your brain at this point?
I was kind of in shock, and my buddy that came and helped me track it and get it out, he was just, He helped me track my deer the year before, and he just like he was just as excited for me as I was, and you know, kind of kneel down and grab the antlers and pick his head up, and he was just as excited, and you know, telling me, oh man, that's a great buck, and I was just so thankful to get the chance to go out, and enjoy it and have that encounter. It it was really exciting.
Yeah.
To hold on to his antler and just a sense of accomplishment. I knew the deer was in the area, even though I hadn't had a picture of him for a month. I was confident he would still be around. He was the biggest buck on camera all year and had been. I ran the cameras after.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he was by far the biggest. He was the most mature. He was 3.5 years old. And just to, it almost felt surreal to be like, all right, I haven't seen him in a month, but I knew he'd be in the area. And I knew this was my best day to do it. It all came together. And to watch him for as long as I had to, it was hard not to break down, I guess, for a minute there.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's good, man. It's a positive thing. It's this, it's this moment that we all kind of live for, whether you have the ability to, hunt 5 days or you have the ability to get out there and hunt, 50 days. Right.
Right.
It's the moment at the end in somewhat is the same. Right. I mean, I geek out. I think one thing that I really like about this hunting community and doing this podcast is that I love hearing those moments that are similar, but all different for different people. But at the end of the day, it's like, there's moments, there's big moments or little moments, or, like for me, some of the moments that I can think of is like, my wife being there when my wife shot her first turkey, or, some of these moments that are upcoming for me, like when I get to take my kids out hunting at some point, or walking up on a shed antler and picking it up and just being like, dude, I am the first human to ever touch this. You know what I mean?
Right.
Or pick a buck's head up, or that you've been chasing for a while, or, you put a lot of time and energy into. I don't know. It's these moments that, and to be honest with you, I don't know how you feel, and I'm kind of going off on a tangent here, but I've never, I don't do a lot of reading or of, author, I don't read a lot of books or magazine articles where people try to describe this really deep philosophy behind hunting, or, express all these emotions and stuff, because I feel like, one, that's something that someone has to go experience for themselves, and two, it never is relatable to me, because I just feel like something's just a little bit different. I love hearing people's experiences. I love, the stories and all that. I mean, that's why I'm doing what I'm doing, but I don't know. That's just, I'm a freak, I guess.
Yeah, everybody's reaction is going to be slightly different, and, everybody takes it all differently.
Yeah. All right. So you're not done yet. Being a resident there in Michigan, you get two tags. So, what was the next step, right? You hunted one more day, but then on the 13th, you went back into timber, and this was on a different farm, correct?
Yeah. Yep. All right. This is on a new property.
All right. So real quickly, describe this property. How many acres, terrain, ag, thickness?
About 10 to 12 acres.
Small parcels.
Right there. Small parcels. It's off of a pretty big river here locally. Mostly all phragmites. And there is about a 2 acre, 1.5 to 2 acre chunk of river bottom that would, when you watch Kansas and whatnot, all the huge trees in it, kind of wide open. The ground is all green and clear in the middle of all these phragmites. And that was where I wanted to get into. There's a dike system that runs parallel to the river about 15, 20 yards in off the river, and the phragmites that border the river. I found a buck bed on there in early October when I scouted it, but it was I don't want to say impossible, but it would be difficult to try and flip in on him where he was bedded. He was bedded right up at the point of this dike that was about 7 to 8 feet tall, so he could see over a lot of the phragmites and see down any of the down the one main groom trail that ran parallel to the dike.
Yeah.
So he had escape routes. So it's like, okay, this is where he's bedding, but I couldn't push it because of wind factors too. So I eased off of it to the would be southeast a little ways, figuring that when he goes to come in, he's going to come in through this clearing or skirt it and then go up to his bed to catch the wind, the predominant north-northwest wind, to get into his bed.
Okay.
And I hunted almost right smack in the middle of the clearing to just off the edge of the center of it. And in it was a lot of like duck potato, I guess what they have out in Iowa.
I guess I'm not familiar with that term.
Yeah, I don't know, the THP guys, that's what they call it on one of their...
Duck potato?
They call it duck potato. Oh. It's like some green vegetation that the deer eat a lot in the wintertime.
Oh.
Of these river bottoms.
Okay.
But nothing I had personally ever seen before other than on one of their videos. I was like, all right, well, it's going to be more of a late season food source. But also with this dike system and all the phragmites and as thick and nasty as it is around here, yeah, if these bucks start chasing does, the does are going to want to come into the clearing to get out of all that stuff.
Yeah.
And the bucks are going to try and use the phragmites and the dike as a way to kind of corral them in there. And so I set up my stand October 3rd, shot that doe on October 5th, and then the 13th of November, it was when the warm weather in the Midwest had finally broke.
Okay.
And we were coming in, the cold front was coming in, but we did have probably like 20 mile an hour winds. But it's like, well, cold front's here, so I have to at least go give it a shot.
Okay.
And I kicked up a couple of deer that were right under my tree stand as I was walking in. Small 6 point and a doe took off, and then I watched a couple of does throughout the evening, and then just before dark, right by the end of legal shooting time, I just hear all holy heck break out in front of me. Straight out in front of me would be to the southwest.
Yeah.
And I knew exactly what it was. There wasn't even a doubt in my mind. There was a buck going to be on a doe. And I had a doe decoy out in front of me. I put a doe decoy out about 17, 18 yards out in front of me. And this buck is hot on this doe, and she came running directly at me. And she went to hook to go to the north, and she saw my doe decoy standing there, and she absolutely froze. And he's about 10, 15 yards behind her, facing me. And I'm just like, oh, gosh. Did this doe decoy just cost me this deer? Like, this will be the biggest buck I've ever shot in Michigan. Shooting it with a bow. And I think a tactic that I've used many, many times before is going to cost me the biggest deer. And he put his nose back down, started to approach the doe he was chasing from behind. He started grunting right at her. And I had another small scrub buck come following behind them, and he turned around, chased him off, ran about 10, 15 yards. So he's at about 35 yards away.
Right.
And after he calmed down from that, he turned back around, started walking to that doe, and she was starting to get comfortable around the decoy a little bit, and she proceeded to take a couple steps into the opening, and before he got completely into the clearing, that was when I drew.
Yeah.
And at about 22 yards broadside is when I'd taken the shot.
at 25?
About 22 yards, yeah.
Yeah. Was he tense at that point, or was he just really relaxed?
He was relaxed as far as from chasing off the other buck, but he was all rutted up. He didn't have his ears pinned back or anything, but he was getting ready to put his nose back down and push her.
Yeah.
Right as I was getting ready to release the arrow. He was standing there for a minute, and all of a sudden he started to drop his head down just as I was releasing the arrow. And I had actually dropped my arm. I did peek, I will admit that.
Yeah.
And I still ended up hitting him good and getting him, but for a second there, I thought I'd missed, but.
Yeah. And then, so you thought you missed, but then, like, how much time went by before you kind of realized, no, I did hit him? Did you have to get out of the tree stand to identify that?
Yeah. I could see my arrow down there, but I couldn't get a good read on it with the foliage behind it and stuff. And some of the taller, you know, knee high grasses in there. And all of a sudden I got down to it and it's coated in blood. I'm like, oh, yeah. Oh, and I look over and I'm like, oh, there's some blood. And I just kept walking. I was like, wow, there's a lot of blood here. And, so I went back to the truck, put my pad, I dropped a bunch of gear off and my everything at the truck, grabbed my bow and my backpack and, changed my boots and headed in to start tracking at least a little bit. And all of a sudden it just opened right up and I knew he was big when I'd seen him. I more or less saw his frame when he was chasing that doe. And then I just focused on trying to get a shot. And then when I got up to him, that was when I realized how big he actually was.
Yeah. So now, that was your biggest buck. Now, does this buck beat the buck that you shot on November 1st?
Yes.
Yes. Yep. Okay. So out of curiosity, you know, describe the first buck that you shot.
Oh, more or less a typical Michigan 3.5-year-old. Well, his body was big, but antlers, he was 16 inches wide, like 3.5 to 4 inch brow tines, and then his G2s would have been about 6 inches.
Yeah,
G3s were right at about 4, and then his one side had the G4 at, I don't know, about 3 inches. You know, not a monster compared to what a lot of other people are shooting, but it probably 95, maybe 100 inch deer, maybe a little bit better, somewhere right in there.
Yeah.
But at that point it was the biggest buck I'd ever shot in Michigan. So
yeah.
To me it was all about that.
All right. So now this buck that you just, did you know when this buck came through that he was the biggest buck then that you ever shot?
No, I didn't realize he was quite to that magnitude.
Okay. So then, so it took you until you walked up on him to realize that then?
Right. Yeah. I'd seen his frame was pretty good size, and I was just focusing on trying to get a shot. And then after that other one, smaller buck had come following up behind them and he chased them off. All I was doing was just focusing on that front shoulder and the 8 to 10 inches behind it.
Yeah. All right. So now describe this buck to us. Roughly, what do you think he scored? Describe his characteristics. How old do you think he was?
He was 3.5.
Okay.
With a lot better genetics. He was 3.5. About 18 inches wide. His G2s were right in the, I believe one was around 11 and the other one was around 9.5 to 10. And his G3s were both in that 8.5 to 9 inch region. Kind of tight. Didn't go out or towards his nose. He was a tight wrapped rack. Brow tans were about 4.5 to 5 inches, and he did score around a taxidermy score around 120 3/8.
Okay, so now this guy is your biggest, and so after you just shoot the two biggest deer that you've ever shot on minimal time, right? On like mm-hmm. on 5 total days of hunting, you take down two deer.
Property had no trail camera or anything. That was just I scouted in October. So this is the spot. What I thought to be the spot within the spot of where I wanted to be, and that was it. The small property, I had the trail camera history, but the second one, no trail cameras or nothing. It was more or less. I'm gonna get what I get.
Yeah, but it all kind of worked out, and it sounds to mm-hmm. me like regardless, it's one hell of a year, man.
Yeah, it was one that it'll be tough for me to beat in Michigan for quite some time.
Yeah. So after you have a killer season like this, you know, it's your personal best. It's a hunting career defining moment or a year for you. How do you go into next year now? I mean, what kind of conversations are you having with yourself? It's like, okay, do I now potentially try to bump up to 4 year old, or do I go for bigger antlers, or is your goal maybe more time in the woods? Like, what kind of conversations are you having with yourself?
Right now I need to be in the woods scouting, doing postseason scouting.
Yeah.
And that's going to be coming up here pretty quick. And I do have, I have a family member that likes to razz me a little bit, because they go up and they do a big hunting camp and whatnot in northern Michigan. And I likes to throw the ribbing out of, oh, shot that out, you know, we're hunting public land or state land.
Right.
And during gun season, and, well, for years they've baited and stuff like that, and it's like, well, so my challenge to myself and like I mentioned, Bob Miller, and I, he's going to, we're, our goal is to try and take a couple of Hope and Young, or try to get up near their public land deer, more or less e-scout, boost to the ground, here in the springtime, and just go in and hang and bang. But that's my goal, is to try and this family member kind of ribbon me a little bit. I want to more or less go in public land and try and get it done.
Right. So not necessarily a different type of deer goal, but a goal on a different piece of property, kind of shooting from the hip, being a lot more mobile, you know, going into untapped ground type of deal.
Yeah. Sometimes you just almost get this feeling like he doesn't think I can get it done somewhere else. So, all right, well, that's going to be my goal this year, is to get out there and hunt some state ground, just go out and make it happen.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you what, man, sounds like you had one hell of a year. Congratulations, man. Good luck this upcoming year.
And
thank you for taking time out of your day to hop on and chat with us. And I'll tell you this, I'm looking forward to how your public land adventures go.
I got a feeling it's either go really good or, it'll be one heck of a grind.
Right. Well, just take it as a learning experience, right?
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
Cool,
well,
man.
I appreciate you having me on, Dan.
And there you have it, guys and gals, another episode in the books, man. Huge shout out to all of you. Thanks to you for making what I do work. And if it wasn't for you, man, I don't know where I'd be. I'd probably still be in a cubicle somewhere. But I really appreciate your attention, your time, your energy, and keep an eye out for the Nine Fingered Kitchen coming soon. Huge shout out to all of the partners of the podcast. We have Vortex Optics, Ozonics, Wasp, and Lone Wolf. Please go out and support the companies that support this podcast. And other than that, man, get outside. It's shed season. This is a perfect opportunity to get children out, to get new hunters out and excited, to get the wife out, or just to get out, period. Disconnect from the phone. Disconnect from the computers, the TVs, the social media, and just breathe fresh air, man. It will cure your problems. I guarantee it. Have a good day. Take care, and we'll talk to you next time. You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.